So how do you describe what it is that we're all living through right now? It's just beyond words. This past week, a news reporter asked me as I'm standing in the rain with black gloves on and a pole and just simply said, did you ever in a million years ever picture yourself as a pastor handing out toilet paper on the end of a stick to be in order to meet a need in our community? No. I mean, how could you possibly ever imagine anything like that ever happening? And I started thinking about all the different emotions and words that we've used to describe what we've been through just over the past couple weeks. I think the first thing that really kind of came out was somewhere between disappointed and devastated, depending on how important these different things were in your life that began to get shut down. For instance, when you realized there was going to be no March Madness, disappointed. And then maybe if you're a soccer fan and Champions League got canceled and then you realize baseball season was going to be postponed, that the NBA season is going to be postponed or maybe even canceled at this point, we really don't even know. Your children's soccer leagues or maybe what you were looking forward to doing this year, your vacation you had planned for spring break. And as those things, one by one, you realize they were getting canceled and taken away, you were somewhere between disappointed and devastated. Maybe for some of you in that moment, your first thought was miracle. I mean, this is a miracle from God. Maybe you had a test that was coming up and you had no idea how you were going to get out of it because you weren't ready for it. And all of a sudden, you know, everything just kind of aligned and you don't have to do that test anymore. Or maybe I'm sure somewhere in the world there is a husband who finally agreed to go to the ballet and bought tickets and miracle of God, he doesn't have to go now. So I don't really know what your word was when all this first became out, whether it was disappointed or devastating, or maybe you looked at this as a miracle. But somewhere it moved towards a place where you kind of got sad or frustrated when you saw people hoarding things, especially when you saw people hoarding things like masks and sanitizer that are desperately needed for those who are serving our community in the medical field right now. Or you saw people who are hoarding toilet paper and literally have enough toilet paper to last them 17 years or through a lot of really bad, no, I'm not even going to say anything about Taco Bell. It was just, and then it moved into this place of just surreal, where you saw these news footage pieces where they showed signs of major tourist attractions, not just here in America, but around the world. I mean, you saw the Eiffel Tower with nobody there. You saw the Grand Canal in Venice just as clear as, you know, blue waters you could see in the Bahamas because nobody's on them. Or you saw the Roman Colosseum with nobody at it, or Times Square with nobody walking around and moving around throughout places like that. And it's just absolutely surreal. This really feels like as if we're living like something out of a movie scene right now. And then went from surreal to, I think the word I hear a lot is just crazy. Everybody just keeps saying this just whole thing is just absolutely crazy. While it may not be the most profound observation, it's definitely probably the most common. And then maybe that move from this is crazy to I'm going crazy. 1 or 2 weeks with the kids out of school, I'm about to go crazy. And then once you realize that it's not just 1 or 2 weeks, but now this is a 6-month-long summer vacation that you're facing, and you're thinking to yourself, how am I not going to go crazy during this time? And then, of course, there's the spiritual dimension to all this. And, you know, how do you process this spiritually? What words come to your mind spiritually as you're thinking about everything that's going on? And I can tell you this right now, you will never again read James chapter 4, verses 13 to 16 the same again. And the word that comes to mind when you read James is humbling. Never again, I think, will anybody ever read this passage the same. It simply says this, now listen, you who say tomorrow or today we'll go to this city or to that city, we'll spend a year here or there and carry on business or make money. Why? You don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life anyway? You're just a mist that appears for a little while, then vanishes. And instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we'll live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes, and all boasting is evil. I don't think we'll ever read those words again that says, you don't know what will happen tomorrow. I mean, there is no way you could possibly have predicted or seen what was coming. We used to use words like there's no way in a different context. Like just about 2-3 months ago, I was asking a friend of mine who had this trip planned to go to Italy for work. And I said, hey, you think there's any way you can get out of this? He's like, oh, there's no way, man. There's no way. That's, you know, the boss says we got to go. We got to go. Yeah, he's not going to Italy right now. I mean, what we thought was no way all of a sudden is actually happening right now. It's where we're living in an era that we thought was no way, and now the things we thought that were no way are all happening. Or for some of you, you bought something on credit this past month, and if I would have asked you, hey, is there any way that you'll be in doubt that you can pay that or not? You'd be like, oh, there's no way. I mean, you looked at the economy, you had a solid job, the stock market was at an all-time high, anybody who wanted a job had one. As a matter of fact, it was hard to even find somebody to get hired. And if I were to ask you, do you think you'd be applying for unemployment right now? You'd look at me like, there's no way. And yet, it's all happened. And we all realize we're a lot more vulnerable and a lot more powerless than we ever thought we were. And we never would have called our thought process arrogant. But really, when you begin to think about it in the context James is putting it, in the context of the world that we're living in right now, you begin to see there's a certain level of arrogance where we just assume our tomorrows. We just assume tomorrow is going to be like today. Where we just assume that because of all the things that we have ordered out, because of all the plans that we've made and the surety of what we feel like we know, and all the things that we feel are constants, we feel like we can know or predict or determine what it is that we're going to be doing or where we're going to be. And James, inspired by God, just comes back and says, whoa, whoa, whoa. It's arrogant for you to just assume all of those things. And we've all seen, the entire world has seen, just like that, God can change everything and put everything on pause. It was just this past year in the transition series, I did a series called In Transit back last summer, where I said, isn't it amazing that just like that, God can change your entire world? Now, when I said it, I was talking about how he does it for individuals. I never in a million years imagined or even had the realm of possibility that God just like that could change everybody in the entire world's life in just a moment. But he has. And the thing is this season that we're going through right now, the whole world is on pause and we don't know for how long. We have no idea how long this is going to last. But we all have this unique time to stop and think about life. Before life begins again, because at some point everything's going to ramp back up. At some point, you're going to be back in the swing of things. At some point, you're going to be too busy once again to stop and really think about what is really important in life. And you have this time to sort of just pause and think about, what is important in life? What is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of life? And in this unique season, if it points to anything, it's a reminder that this life really is about nothing more than a loving relationship with Jesus Christ that you'll enjoy for all eternity. Because if your life has been about anything else other than that, it's been challenged, it's been questioned, it's possibly been taken away. I mean, at some point, well, another thing I said in that In Transit series was this question. I said, and this is kind of scary now looking back on it, is I asked the question, what does God have to remove from your life for you to make him the center of your life? What does God have to remove from your life to make him the center of your life? Because, and I said this also, because God will stop at nothing to get you to realize that he needs to be the center of your life. God will stop at nothing for you to realize that this life is about nothing more than a loving relationship with him that will last for all eternity. And part of me figures, or almost sees God right now looking down going, how you like me now? I told you. It's really blowing my mind right now to think that's a reality I've always known, and now our entire world is living in it. I mean, if you didn't think that God would stop at nothing to get your attention, does he have your attention now? If you go back into the Bible, you can go to the Bible, or actually, the most famous, well-known, oldest moral law that we know of anywhere in the world actually comes from the Bible in the Old Testament. It's in Exodus chapter 20, what's known as the Ten Commandments. The very first of the Ten Commandments says this, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. Which leads, of course, to the obvious question, well, what are the other gods we could possibly have before God? And he goes ahead and answers that question with the second commandment, which comes right after in Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. And he says, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or on the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. He's saying nothing in the world should be something that you worship. So what is something that you What is something that is an idol? So, because, you know, we think oftentimes of idols like being a little statue, little thing that people worship, but an idol is simply this. I want to make sure I get this right. I want to read this to you. An idol is anything that is more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and your imagination more than God. Anything that you seek to give you what only God can give you. Anything that becomes so central or so essential to your life that if you should lose it, you'll begin to feel like life is hardly worth living. An idol is anything that has such a controlling passion in your heart that you spend most of your time and your energy, your emotional and your financial resources on it without even a second thought. It could be your family and your children, could be your achievement or critical acclaim, it could be a career, making money, it could be a romantic relationship, it could be saving face, it could be some sort of job advancement, it could be a competence or a skill, it could be becoming the best at something, or your beauty, or your brains, your intelligence, or what kind of political or social cause you want to reach after. It could be morality or virtue or success even in some area of ministry or in any other realm. It's anything that consumes you, anything that becomes the ultimate source of your meaning and significance and hope and purpose in life. Something that where you would say, if I just have that, then I'll feel like my life has meaning. If I just have that, then I'll know that I have value. If I just have that, then I'll feel like I'm significant and secure. One of the best ways to describe what these things are, it's something that we worship. It's something that we give our worship to. Now we often, you know, if you're here at church, you know, watching this, you're thinking to yourself, worship is what you do at church. No, worship is what we are made to do. We worship everywhere. And I read this online, and it just kind of stopped me as I just paused and was thinking about really what's going on and contemplating all this, and it was just simply said this: in 3 short months, just like God did with the plagues of Egypt, God has taken away everything we worship. It's as if God looked down on humanity and said, you want to worship athletes? I'll shut down your stadiums. You want to worship actors? I'll shut down your theaters. You want to worship musicians? I'll shut down your concerts. You want to worship money? I'll shut down your economy and I'll collapse the stock market. You want to worship your intellect? I'll take away the schools. You want to worship your job or your status? I'll take that away too. Are you really too busy for me? I can solve that too. And if you don't want to go to church and worship me, fine. I'll bring church to you. I think we can all see God will stop at nothing, literally nothing, to get not just your attention, but the entire world's attention to become the center of your life. Now, I mean, typically he does this on an individual basis. Like if you read the book of Job, it's all about God basically shutting down Job's life, taking everything out of Job's life, so the only thing he has left is God. And it's this question is, am I enough for you, Job? Am I enough? And Job comes back at the end, he says, yes, God, you are enough. If I have nothing else but you, naked I came into this world, and naked I'll leave it, but God, you are enough for me. You're enough. And typically, God does this on an individual basis. What's so, I don't know what the right word is here, unique, is that right now, God is doing this with everybody in the entire world. He's putting everything on pause. It's as if he's basically taken away everything else that could distract you from this moment to get you to focus on him. I mean, the only distraction left at this point is just basically a gun-toting gay polygamist who's a zookeeper out there who has a, you know, some bone to pick with some lady named Carol. I don't know. If you've watched The Tiger King, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, well, thank goodness you haven't wasted 7 hours of your life on that, where at least maybe the only benefit is that you may feel a little bit better about your life choices. However, you're probably no closer into figuring out the meaning of life if you've been distracted by that. So once you've moved through that distraction, you're going to find there really is no other distraction left other than God coming back to you and saying, okay, what is the most important thing in your life? Do I really have to take something else away, remove something else from your life to get your attention so you'll focus once again on me? Because if your meaning or your purpose or your happiness or your fulfillment or your hope in life is about anything other than your relationship with Jesus that you'll enjoy for all eternity, then right now you've been experiencing some level of fear, worry, or anxiety. And the question we all have to answer is God enough for you? Many years back, I was studying through Hebrews chapter 11, and I came across this quote. It was 4 months before my wife passed away. It was almost like as if God was preparing me for a season where everything I knew in life was going to be stripped away and everything in my life was going to be changed. And it had to do with what goes on in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 is sometimes known as the Hall of Faith. It's all these people who live these great lives of faith. But if you look at the underground, what's going on in the context of their life, when they're making the decisions, most of the people who are making these decisions are having their entire life turned upside down. That they're having to basically strip away or take away everything they've known. You've got a story in there of Abraham who's called to leave his family, leave his hometown, and go somewhere new where all he has is God. It talks about how in faith he follows after God. It talks about the story of Moses, where Moses has to give up his royal family and all of his prominence and everything he has going for him, and is he going to follow God in this moment? Will God be enough for him? It's a question that's asked, and then it goes through all the different stories of people like David and Noah and Daniel and Samson and everybody else. And sort of this one summary statement of all of them is in verse 26 of chapter 11. It says, they were willing to regard disgrace for the sake of Christ as of being greater value than all the treasures of their life as they have known it. Why? It says, because they were looking forward and they were looking ahead to their reward. In other words, what he's saying here basically is they looked at their loving relationship with Jesus Christ as being of far greater worth and value than anything else this life had to offer them. And they were just focused on spending eternity with him. And they said, that's of greater value than anything else. And it was because of that mindset that they had the kind of faith that's talked about in Hebrews chapter 11. And so this quote that I read in studying this, then turned and said, the greatest challenge in your life is simply this, that you will cultivate such a deep and satisfying relationship with God that you can rest in him. And that relationship, whether living or dying, comfortable or miserable, that you'll have such a confident, unshakable confidence that God himself is better than anything that life can give you or death can take from you. This is the kind of faith that we read about in Hebrews chapter 11. That your relationship with God and what you have in him is better than anything this life can give you or death or this virus or anything else can take away from you. That's the greatest challenge in life, because everything else in life is vying for your attention, vying for your affection, vying for your worship, vying for you to be distracted by that or give your life to that or get focused on that or endeavor into that. Everything else is trying to pull you away from the one reality that this life is about nothing more than a loving relationship with God that you'll be able to enjoy for all eternity. I guess what I want to say to you is don't waste this season. Don't waste this time where everything's on pause. I can't tell you why God is allowing this to happen, but I can come back and say, I can tell you that this is the perfect season of your life to think about your priorities. To answer the question, is God enough for you? Is God the number one thing in my life? Is he my ultimate source of meaning and happiness and purpose and hope in life? Is my life really about nothing more than my loving relationship with him that I'll enjoy for all eternity? Yes, I love sports, but I'm going to put that in the proper context. And yes, I love my family, I'm going to put that in the proper place. And yes, I love my job, but I'm going to put that in its proper place. There's a lot of other things that are not bad things. But when I make them the ultimate thing, they'll suck the life out of me. And when I make them the ultimate thing in my life, I got to realize in a moment like this, they can all be taken away. And one day at death, they all will be taken away. And the only thing I will have left is my loving relationship with the God who created me, with his son who came to die for me. And I'll be able to enjoy that for all eternity if I invest in that now. And when the sports comes back on and the movie theaters reopen and we all get back to work and the economy's roaring again, God gives us a warning and he says, now listen, when that all happens again, you're going to forget me. That's been the life cycle of humanity. If you go back, the Ten Commandments were written and were given to the people where God says, have no other gods before me. What happens right then is they come out of Egypt. This is the whole let my people go thing. They come out of Egypt. They part the Red Sea. They get over to the other side of the Red Sea, and God gives them the Ten Commandments. He says, all right, now, I want you to know from here on out, everything I just did to you, I just showed you, I am your God, I've rescued you, I've cared for you, have no other gods before me. And you can just picture, they're like, okay, no other gods. Right, clear, I got you on that. And then they spend 40 years in a wilderness where life as they know it is completely changed, where they have no idea how long they're going to be there. They see some similarities. They have no longer how long they're going to be there. Resources are unlimited supply, and they have nothing but God to rely on during this time. And when you get to the book of Deuteronomy, God is preparing them for what's coming next. He's preparing them to lead them into a place that was going to be known as the Promised Land, where once again, they have everything that they could ever want. They have their job again, and they have their life again, and they have entertainment again. And in Deuteronomy chapter 8, he begins with this word, remember. Why does somebody say remember? They say it because they know you're going to forget. And it's as if God can already look into the future and see what's going to happen. He says, listen, I know during this time you're going to learn some things, and you're going to see some things, and you're going to realize some things. And you're going to have a moment where you think to yourself, you have such clarity about what's important in your life, that you're going to think to yourself, I could never go back to living like I did before. It's like, no, you will. Unless you do something about it. Unless you make a decision. Unless you give yourself some reminders. And so he says this. Remember how the Lord your God has led you all the way through the wilderness these past 40 years. And I led you through this wilderness, it says, to humble you and to test you in order that you might know what was in your heart, and to know whether or not you would keep my commandments. Yes, God humbled you, causing you to hunger. And then he fed you and he taught you that man does not live by bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. He says, I want you to remember all these lessons that you learned. So the people in the wilderness, as they went through there, they realized they could trust God, they could rely on God. God was a source of everything they needed in life. They learned that lesson. It took them 40 years. I have no idea how long this pandemic is going to last. I'm hoping it's far less than what we expect. But he says, I've taught you these lessons in this time. Just don't forget them. And here's the thing is, you will forget these lessons unless you do something to wisely use this time to really reorder your life, to be conscious about what it is that really is your source of meaning and happiness, fulfillment, and purpose. And you need to leave yourself some reminders of the decisions that you make during this season, the things that God shows you during this time, whether it be a sticky note you put on the mirror or something you put in your car, or just maybe something you carve or write down, something that would just always bring you back to what it is you remembered and what it is you learned. You know, maybe as you go and you take something that, you know, represents something that was central focus in your life, and you just write, this will never be number one. Maybe you write on something and you just put, this is my number two, or I need to put this in its right place, or this is fun, but it's not everything. Whatever you need to do during this time so you won't forget the lessons that God is teaching you during this amazing, unique season of the existence of humanity right now. Will you pray with me? Father, I thank you for the opportunity we have, not just individually, but and not even just communally, but for the entire world just to pause. To have everything we worship be wiped away. To give many of us time at home with family. Father, what some people may consider to be boredom or is really just a time that you've given us to think about and to contemplate and search out what really is the most important things in our life. What really do I need to survive? Where do I really find my meaning and purpose and happiness and significance? And God, if nothing ever comes back,
if the job doesn't come back and the economy doesn't come back and sports don't come back and theater doesn't come back and concerts don't come back? I'm okay. Because God, you're enough. May we come to this place in life, and in Jesus' name, amen.